From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we speak with geopolitical analyst Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University, about geopolitics revolving around Syria and also Turkey and Iran. Hey, Mark, welcome back. Pleasure to have you.
Don, it's always good to be on CPR. Been a while.
Yeah, it has. Too long. And let's start with some rather, I don't know, I thought it was rather frightening language, actually, and certainly maybe indicates some strategy on the part of the United States on the battlefield. But Stephen Townsend, who's the new head of U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria, by the way. I don't know how they have
because,
that.
Evidently, this is a new principality of the U.S. empire.
Yeah, because there hasn't been any Security Council resolution authorizing U.S. troops, and there hasn't been an invitation from the Syrian government. So I don't know what legal basis that rests on, but
they have no basic legal basis.
But he said basically after an incident last Thursday where the Syrian Air Force apparently struck at some Kurdish positions that were near or were being supported by, according to Townsend, U.S. Special Forces, that, hey, if you guys, the Russians or the Syrians, get too close to our guys, we're going to shoot back. That's in essence what he said.
Yeah. So let me break it down with some context here. What's going on first, okay? We're talking the very northeast corner of Syria here. A small city of about 200,000 called Hasaka or Al-Hasaka. This is pretty much dead center of what is now Kurdish territory. If you want to call it Rojava, Kurdish-controlled territory in northeast Syria. If you follow a line straight up, of course, you come to the Turkish border. If you follow a line almost straight down, you end up with Manbij, then down onto Deir al-Zor and to Raqqa. So it's a big, long straight line straight down into ISIS territory. But this town is dead center, solid, uncontested Kurdish territory, well away from the front lines. Now, over the entire course of the last 5-6 years of civil conflict in Syria, there has been a Syrian Arab army garrison in this town. The listeners are probably well aware, the Syrian government and the Kurds have not had significant hostilities over the course of the entire conflict. They have both been fighting ISIS since it evolved and took over large parts of territory. They have both been fighting the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army, even though the Kurdish YPG is backed by both the United States and Russia. The YPG has been backed by the Pentagon, while the Free Syrian Army was backed by the CIA. And yes, that is a little bit of a proxy war between U.S. government institutions fighting each other. We haven't had word that any U.S. special forces on either side have actually killed each other. But you know, that is always a possibility,
right, for sure.
With the insanity of the situation.
Friendly fire.
Yeah, friendly. I'm not quite sure how friendly the CIA and the Pentagon are these days. But
yeah, say maybe fraternal fire, like fighting like brothers.
Yeah, it's just the further highlight of the insanity of the Obama administration's policy in Syria. But the Syrian government and the Kurds have largely avoided conflict, which has benefited both the Kurds, who are looking after their own national interests, and the Kurds, spread out between Syria, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and a little beyond even those, are the largest nation of people in the world without a state,
right,
without a nation state of their own.
Right.
And the Kurds get a lot of support from the left in the West, not entirely unwarranted. They are, of their politics are undoubtedly leftish. I would hesitate to call them Marxist-Leninist because it's their own unique socialistish cult that has developed off, but they are certainly that. Leftish, they are secular, and of course, most infamously in the Middle East, they have women who do fight, you know, sometimes on the front lines alongside the men, which makes them kind of a cause célèbre. And uniquely in this Syrian conflict, they have been supported by both the U.S., the Pentagon, and by the Russians. And like I said, they have avoided conflict, any kind of type of major conflict with the Syrian government, concentrating mainly on securing territory of their own, which is Kurdish majority territory in all along the north of Syria, in the northeast, and in the northwest. And they have been trying very ever so slowly to bridge the gap in the middle that is the Jarablus corridor through over Aleppo, through which the majority of the supplies and rat lines that the Erdogan regime in Turkey continues to supply all the various jihadist and Western proxy forces in Syria. And Turkey has angrily multiple times warned the Kurds, you know, when I'm speaking warning, I mean with airstrikes and artillery, that if they cross certain river lines, if they cross certain lines and move further into that Jarablus corridor, we're talking the Euphrates, then that they will take further action. And, you know, they've intimated, of course, that they will send the Turkish military in.
Let me just say here, it's my understanding that when they do the air raids, of course, they need AWACS, which are controlled by the U.S. So when you talk about Turkish airstrikes, there's certainly American involvement, and I would assume that's the Pentagon who has control of those.
Yeah, and I want to be more specific. I am not aware that Turkey has launched any airstrikes against the Kurds in Syria since Turkey shot down a Russian plane on the Turkish-Syrian border
November of last year, a year ago.
Yeah. Before that, they were making loudly announced attacks on ISIS. It's just officially three of those strikes were against ISIS. I'm not sure they hit anything but desert. And 300 of those strikes were against the Syrian Kurds. They have and continue to make airstrikes against the Kurds in Iraq, which is a violation, of course, of Iraq's territory and airspace and sovereignty.
Which Iraq has protested numerous times.
Yes, and the Turks have troops within shall we say, Kurdish dominant territory in Iraq that the government in Baghdad does not want there as well. And they've refused to remove them, kind of a land grab of their own. Because there are Kurds in Iraq who do actually ally with the Turkish government, as insane as that is.
Yeah, those are the traditional U.S. allies there.
Those are the traditional. These are not the Kurds of Turkey and Syria. These are some of the Kurdish mafia clans of northern Iraq, the Barzani and so on.
The oil mafia, yeah.
Yeah. So we've got the Kurds in the Syrian government that have largely avoided conflict. There have been a few small incidents where a handful of people have been killed on a few occasions. Usually this is the result, not even of direct military conflict, but of militias on both sides, not the YPG and the Syrian Arab Army directly, but usually some supporting militias, some hotheads, some youth that have clashed. There have been a handful of deaths over the years, but usually the grown-ups, often the Russians themselves, stepped in, banged a few heads together, and this was resolved so that both of them can concentrate on the big picture, right? You know, the Kurds, you know, securing, you know, some type of a territory and some future, hopefully, you know, autonomy or, you know, they imagine even independence for their own, and the Syrian army, of course, regaining, fighting the jihadists and regaining control of, you know, Syria as a whole.
Right.
So, but Just last week, within the last few days, actually, we had an incident in this town, Hasaka. There has been a Syrian Arab army garrison there over the course of the war. In this town, there have been a few violent incidents, mostly fisticuffs, a few shootings over the years. But like I said, in this town as well, you know, as the big picture, this has largely been kept under control. But there is a large Assyrian Christian minority in this town, particularly in almost the center of the town, around which the Syrian Arab Army garrison is in the middle and has kind of act as the guarantee for. Because while the Kurds have, rightly so, have, you know, the support of leftists, you know, in the West, we have to remember that they are not angels. This is a nasty, brutish civil conflict. This is questions of nation and identity and complicated ethno-religious conflicts and ties. And as has been reported in mainstream Western publications like The Telegraph and so on, and there is definitely some truth to it, some of these Kurds have resorted to what should probably be considered ethnic cleansing of their own. Right. A lot of that against Salafists and Sunni Arabs who may have been supported ISIS or other jihadist groups, you know, that were in largely Kurdish territory that were driven out. But yes, sometimes Christians. And there have been some repeated tensions between Assyrian Christians and the Kurds all across the territories, but particularly in this town.
Let me just put this in perspective for a moment, based on something you said earlier. When you called the Kurds essentially, you know, a people without land, which is the term that was used in Palestine for Jews.
People without a state.
Right, people with it. But the term they used it with respect to Palestine, European Jews referred to themselves as a people without land, and to Palestine as land without a people, which of course it wasn't. But certainly here in what is many people call Kurdistan, in the three countries, a lot of those areas are majority Kurds, and so the dynamics on the ground are different, and the case for self-government or autonomy of some kind is certainly very strong, just as an expression of a democratic impulse.
Yeah, it is. It is. Now, we have to be very careful how far we want to delve into the European ideology of ethnic nationalism. And of course, this was the whole thrust of Wilsonian democracy post-World War I in the United States.
Right.
But hands down, I'm sorry, communism, capitalism, even fascism, nationalism, that is the idea that the borders of one ethnicity and one nation, a political state, should be one and the same, is by far the bloodiest and most destructive ideology in the history, or at least in the modern history, at least in the last 100 or 150 years.
They're replacing and at the same time overlapping religious antagonisms.
Not only religious antagonisms, even overlapping communism. I mean, Lenin had, Marxist Lenin, all had very dubious, they were no friends of nationalism, but they used it, as did later Stalin, in various times and places, to their benefit, because, and I'm sorry to say, nationalism has proven a stronger force than worker solidarity and identity throughout the world.
It faces less hostility from the elites, too.
Yeah, it does. It does, because, you know, some of the elites themselves subscribe to it, especially when those are the elites creating, you know, manufacturing the nation, or, you know, in question. And there's a whole academic literature behind this. So we do live in a world dominated by nation states, but I think we, as intellectually, should hesitate whenever we press on this, because the creation of nation states inevitably causes mass ethnic cleansing and genocide, because no one ethnicity ever totally dominated one territory. It is not historical. It is not natural. It is not organic. These are nation states are created via ideology, genocidal and fratricidal wars, the various institutions of modernity, press, public education. But it is not a clean process, and we should recognize the world we live in, and recognize that the Kurds certainly have some rights. But I think we should take a step back whenever we want to push this idea of a nation, of a right to a nation state too far. Mm-hmm. But political representation, some form of autonomy, autonomous identity, I think we can, it's very much harder to disagree with.
Right.
But in this town, things broke out into conflict in the last week. There's a lot of conflicting stories, of course, what's going on. Most of it seemed to center around antagonism not by the YPG itself, but by Kurdish militias in this town who are supported by the YPG, a local Kurdish militias, mostly youth, NDF militias of the Assyrian Christians, supported by the Syrian Arab Army and their garrison in the town. This then escalated, evidently, into attacks on the Syrian Arab Army garrison itself, somewhat serious attacks. The Syrians responded back. This evidently involved artillery on both sides. Eventually, it got serious enough that the Syrian government sent airstrikes in to support the garrison. I take it that these were mostly, shall we say, warning strikes,
right.
but undoubtedly some people died in them, right, as well, and possibly some civilians.
Right.
So the Western press, of course, tried to make a big deal out of this. They have always salivated at the idea of driving the Kurds against the Syrian government. So they were like hounds on pursuit of this. But of course, it's an extremely complicated story with the local Assyrians, the Kurds, the context, the nuances of which will largely be lost.
So the implications, because you're looking at essentially, at least from a public relations point of view, the development of another set, I guess, if you look across the region, of flashpoints where the U.S. could engage in military conflict with either Syria and or Russia.
You went right where I wanted to go. Now, the big news to come out of this, however, was not the clashes between the Syrian Arab Army garrison and the local auxiliary defense forces themselves, but the fact that there were U.S. advisors to these local Kurdish auxiliary defense forces on the ground, and that the U.S. objected to the airstrikes that were near their advisory special forces. After they made a big show that they sent U.S. coalition jets into the area after the Syrian jets had already left the area and, were somehow sending messages that they shouldn't return, which, of course, the Syrian Air Force did and repeated their actions the next day without any serious challenge. Now we're hearing rhetoric from this General Towns and warnings. And supposedly the Americans initially tried to contact the Syrian government directly, the special forces on the ground. The Syrian government, they say, didn't respond. Mm. They then attempted to contact the Russians, who then dealt with this. As far as I understand, the Russians are now mediating between the two sides. Hopefully they will smack heads again together, the grown-ups in the room.
Right.
This is definitely a flashpoint. But the big question is, to me, is what are the Americans doing in Hasaka.
Yeah, you said this advisors. Let's be clear. We're talking about U.S. Special Forces, which the U.S.
admits. These are Special Forces, yes. Right. This is well beyond the front lines. This is in the absolute center of Kurdish territory in northeast Syria. There is no ISIS anywhere near this town. There is no indication that these are training special. These are special forces conducting training. There is no training set up in this town that they have made public, and they did not even call these special forces trainers. They called them specifically advisors. So who exactly are they advising, and what are they advising them for?
Well, CNN says that they're supporting the Kurdish troops there. So it seems like
supporting
the mission,
them what?
They just used the word supporting, right? So
yes, why are they? What are they supporting them there in? Supposedly, there's only a few hundred Americans in all of Syria. So of course there is some speculation, and I think there are good grounds for it, that these U.S. Special Forces are encouraging, shall we say, some hot-headed Kurdish factions, some militias, some youth, to take military action in the hope of stirring things up between the Kurds and the Syrian government.
Right.
That I believe is a real danger. It fits right in within their playbook, especially as situation with them grows more desperate with their proxies around Aleppo bottled up and, you know, slowly being ground down.
That we're talking about ISIS.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, ISIS is an entirely different, well, not entirely different, but of course, a somewhat different conversation.
Right.
So, bottom line is, I think the Kurds and the Syrian government both need to take a step back and realize that they could be being manipulated into a conflict that is at the present time not in either of their interests. Eventually, there will have to be a reckoning, hopefully a political reckoning, right, between the Kurds and the Syrian government. But in the beginning, right now, they still have existential enemies that would like to see both of them wiped off the map.
Right.
And, you know, hopefully the smarter figures will recognize that, and Russia will mediate between them. This strategy is, however, very dangerous for the Americans, and it could easily backfire on them, because they still rely on the Turkish government, one, to supply their proxies in Aleppo, which is still going on, and if anything, at a doubling down pace, despite the supposed rapprochement between Erdogan and Putin. Secondly, they need Incirlik Air Base. It's not that they couldn't operate at all without it, but it would severely impact their operations.
Yeah.
Not only for the Syrian conflict, but for the, you know, it's an important geostrategic base for their hegemony or would-be hegemony of the region.
You know, and not just that, you know, this is kind of a wild possibility, if it's a possibility at all, but at least theoretically, not just negating it for the U.S., but, I mean, there is the material possibility of it actually becoming a base with Russian participation, which would put Russian planes in that part of the theater in the event of a conflict between NATO and Russia.
Yeah, there's been noise about that, about supposedly the Russians have requested the base, and then they deny that they've requested it. And supposedly the Turks say that they've, you know, that they would be willing to provide it to Russia, but Russia hasn't asked. I don't really take any of this talk seriously.
Yeah, not now, for sure. Yeah.
No, not now, for sure. And I just don't buy into any talk of Turkey leaving NATO. The Turkish military, you know, even with cut down, you know, with its officer corps cut down by up to a third by these purges and, you know, the coup attempt, perhaps even more so than ever, they are reliant on NATO. They're reliant on NATO for their weapons, for their systems, yeah, for everything.
It is like AWACS, for example. I mean, their planes won't work really without it.
They would have to strip down and completely rebuild their military from the ground up. Plus, the EU is Turkey's biggest trade partner by far. I think that this Turkish-Russian rapprochement is largely just balancing. It's very simple realist balancing. It is not some massive geopolitical realignment of Turkey with Eurasia or everything, I think these charges are overblown. Sure. I've seen no evidence of it yet. And I haven't even seen any real evidence of a rapprochement. When we see Turkey begin to at least throttle down on the supply of jihadists, of Al-Qaeda and Ahrar al-Sham and Jund al-Aqsa and then the Turkish Islamic Party and all of these other 31 flavors of jihad, even if they don't close the border, if they began to at least throttle down on the supply lines, the rat lines to these, particularly in above Latakia and Aleppo, then we could begin to talk that Erdogan is serious. But I haven't seen that. To the contrary, there's a lot of evidence with the latest Islamic Army of Conquest offensives around Aleppo and in Latakia that actually they're getting more supplies than ever, brand new uniforms, out-of-the-box weapons, a surfeit of ammo, and more. They are running, you know, from witnesses on the ground on the border, they are running tanks and artillery to these jihadists now at ever-increasing rates. So I don't see Erdogan doing this. And until he does, I don't think we can take any signs of rapprochement, much less realignment seriously. He's playing a game. What I expect, he is... I personally do not believe that there is evidence that the CIA was directly involved in the Turkish coup. I also don't believe the Turkish government's claims that this was Gulenists based out of the U.S. What I do believe is that the U.S. knew about the coup and didn't take sides and didn't offer support to Erdogan, as NATO hasn't done in previous Turkish military coup attempts over, you know, the course of the last 30 years. They didn't take a side until it was obvious who was going to win. They hedged their bets. And when they did finally respond, Erdogan was angry at the lack of support. And I think he is using that as part of the rationale for his purges against everyone, against Gulenists, against Kemalists, against liberals, communists, everyone who might oppose his, you know, complete power in the country. And further, I'll go even a bit further. He will try to blame this on Obama, and within a year of Hillary Clinton taking office, he will suddenly find cause for a reset, a rapprochement with the United States, and he will try to blame everything away on Obama, the same way he tried to blame the whole cause of his bad relations away on Gulenists in the military, which is just an insult to the Russians' intelligence and an insult to the Russian people who aren't really buying it either.
Right, you know, and... Well, first of all, I had brought up this merely to illustrate the question of the base, to illustrate the strategic value of it. Because if that happened by some unforeseen
circumstances,
it's a huge score and a huge loss by the United States. And also the political consequences of that here in the United States, of basically having this coup pinned on the administration, whether rightly or wrongly, and then the result being this, you know, huge foreign policy loss, there'd be some tremendous political consequences here in the U.S. But I'm thinking, though, of Erdogan's political situation, because before, one could argue, his power rested largely on the United States, and if things are as they appear, and the U.S. was either hedging its bets or involved on the one hand, and he was saved by a phone call from Moscow, he recognizes, I'm certain, that, well, the base of my power now has shifted some, and I have to play both sides. That and what's happening with the Kurds right now, in the event the U.S. is backing the YPG in an aggressive stance against the Syrian government, while you feel this shift of political foundation in Ankara, do you think that he could have the material conditions exist suddenly, or recognize that they exist, for him to change his policy towards Syria?
Okay, so this is the big question. Can he, will he, does he have the rationale for it? I still believe he's playing everyone for leverage.
For sure.
He is essentially blackmailing the EU and the US again, the EU for probably for visa free and for
membership,
billions to support the refugees, the US for whatever purposes. Erdogan has made a completely mixed statements since then about Assad. He's repeated that Assad must go. This hasn't changed. And then he says that he's had some of his foreign ministers that suggested, well, Assad can stay for the interim, but he's still got to go in the end, and so on. So they're making purposefully, I think, vague and ambiguous statements that everyone can read into it what they want to read into it.
And they're doing it, too. They're doing it, too.
Right now, Erdogan is focused on consolidation of his regime in his country. His goal of bringing down the Syrian government has turned everyone into his that he had good relations with everyone into bad relations with everyone in the neighborhood and with his NATO backers in the past year. It's been a huge disaster. But can he really reverse course on this? He has supported all of these jihadists. I mean, they operate openly out of Turkish cities where they gather, they do training, they organize, they arm. I mean, this is, you know, it's like Disney World, for jihad now. I mean,
yeah,
there's no question, as Putin said, that Turkey is a state sponsor of terror.
Yeah, look at a map. If you look at a map, okay, I mean, these forces and their material did not beam in from the USS Enterprise. They traveled over actual real estate. And if you look at a map, there's only one piece of real estate they could enter from, and that's Turkey.
No, I mean, well, they have been coming in from the south. There is a separate southern front, particularly the southern front that largely was trained up by the CIA out of Jordan as well.
I'm talking about all the troops and materiel that are in northern Syria.
Northern Syria, you're right. This is geographically. If the Turkish border was closed, the insurgency, the jihad, whatever you want to call it, would collapse.
Right.
Period. Right. Turkey does have one of the largest militaries in the world. And on paper, it's a pretty significant military.
Right.
Some of it, at least up to NATO standards, with a lot of NATO gear. Now, of course, they've had a huge purging of their officer corps, and there's a lot of chaos right now. But they could close that border if they wanted to. But if they did, the Erdogan regime would be then facing not two civil conflicts, one against a civil war against the Kurds on his own territory, hopefully for him, finished prospect of a Kemalist military coup, but that he cannot entirely discount. He can't completely trust the military, at least not for a few more years of purges and reorganization. But then a third conflict with the very same jihadists that he has been either directly or indirectly supporting, depending on the group, for the last 6 years. You know, we have seen ISIS terrorist attacks in Turkey. And I do believe that at least some of those probably were ISIS, right? These other groups that were much more closely aligned with the Turkish government, like Ahrar al-Sham, Jundal Aksa, and so on, these would openly turn against the Turkish government. They would lash out. They are based, not just formal operations centers, but in refugee camps and in towns across Turkey. Right. He would be facing a terrorist threat, the likes of which, the Kurds haven't truly represented so far. So that's one really good reason why he can't do that, at least not in a big way. And I really seriously, unfortunately, don't expect to see it. However, if I'm wrong, I'll be the first one to eat crow and rejoice.
Let me
finish with one more thing. But right now, other than regime consolidation, the second biggest thing on Erdogan's mind right now is moving away from overthrowing the Syrian government and increasing concern over a Kurdish autonomy, independent state in Syria that would encourage the Kurds within his own borders. Right. And if the U.S. is seen as increasingly supporting the Kurds in fact, against the Syrian government. That has the potential to push Erdogan closer towards the Russian and Syrian government position to some degree, and further away from the West. So the West, in supporting the Kurds in Hasaka and elsewhere, is for them a very dangerous geopolitical game. And this is what we're all in a game here. Everyone is dancing around each other around the issue of the Kurds. Something is going to have to break somewhere, some way. If not soon, well, then at least in the medium term.
What about in Kurdistan, you know, the region?
Let's call it what they call it for purposes now in Syria, Rojava.
Okay, but I'm thinking of that and the Kurdish areas in Turkey and Iraq.
And Iran.
Right, okay. So, but these three that are directly involved in this war, you know, in terms of it being fought on their territory, because there's also been uprisings in Turkey and fighting there.
And fighting in Iraq as well.
Yeah. And in Iraq. The idea of a nation state for Kurds is very strongly held among the masses of people in those three regions. And it has been, it's found expression in various ways, you know, particularly since 1991 with the U.S. involvement in Iraq at that time. And manipulated, disappointed, frustrated, all, you know, a number of things. If there were some effort by, let's say, Damascus to pacify it by, you know, the way that they've dealt with the Syrians, for example, who've taken up arms against the government. They've offered them amnesty and said, come be part of a political settlement. And that's been successful to a large degree. And I'm wondering if a similar move is made with some, you know, major concession towards autonomy to the Syrian Kurds, if that might be a magnet that would force the issue both in Turkey and, more importantly, against, say, Barzani and others in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Yeah, it would. It could potentially destabilize Iraq, Turkey, even extending into the question of the not insignificant Kurdish minority in Iran. Yeah, it would destabilize the whole region. Everyone is very concerned about this. And, you know, we all recognize that the Kurds deserve something, but is federalization a step too far for the Syrian government? We don't know yet. We haven't gotten that close to the end of the war, and right now, hopefully, they'll concentrate on their shared enemies before we politically settle this. But, of course, it can't be put completely to the table, and hence all this political maneuvering and so on, because it will have to be dealt with eventually.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking of as a possible model, for example, would be autonomous provinces inside Iraq, Turkey, and Syria, which Syria seems willing to entertain. They've discussed it before. And then some sort of confederation of those autonomous regions in terms of trade agreements and who knows what else.
Yeah.
That would have, you know, internal borders, maybe the national borders in terms of enforcement would be at the Kurd borders in each of those countries rather than where they currently exist. But they would be part of the three nation states and have relations among themselves that sort of transcend that.
Okay, that sounds on paper really interesting. It is a far more radical solution and a more radical, as it will be seen by them, assault on the sovereignty of Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran.
For sure.
Far more so than has been the Irish settlement or has been the Bosnia and Herzegovina. And this would be a far more radical a solution with you know the potential erosion of these countries' sovereignty, something
right.
I can't see them accepting.
Right.
But you know, of course, it all sounds very interesting. But one of the Kurds' problems historically, it continues to be, is that the Kurds are not a united people. They are divided. They are a people that is largely a tribal, hill people historically. That's how their society evolved. And hill peoples, again, we're talking some convolutions of sociology and geology and the environment here, have always been divided peoples. Every different valley is a different faction, a clan, the slightly different ethno-religious takes and so on, much less the big divisions between the four of these and the four different countries and beyond. The Kurds aren't even united in Syria, as we've seen with the situation with Hasaka, much less across the length of Syria or stretching into these other territories. We're talking huge political differences, almost night and day political differences between the leftist PKK and the YPG, for instance, and the hyper-mafia neoliberal mafia states run by the Barzani right. and other clans in northern Iraq.
Right.
So
I'm thinking.
I don't have much hopes. I'll say it's a beautiful dream for the Kurds, but it's not going to happen.
I'm just thinking in terms of the gravitational forces that could be set in motion. Where, say, Barzani sitting on top of a bunch of Kurdish mass, on top of a Kurdish mass that does want this unification, being forced more or less to the table from the bottom.
Yeah, well, let's complicate this situation more and realize that there's a significant amount of hydrocarbons, particularly in Iraq, but also in Syria's territory, underneath all of this,
right.
And throw in the geopolitical and geo-energy on top of all of this. Does everyone want from the Kurds, as well as what do they want for the Kurds?
Well, it's no coincidence that Barzani, et cetera, are sitting in exactly that location where the hydrocarbons happen to be situated.
Been very intent on exerting their autonomy from Baghdad in this area, which has angered Baghdad to no degree. But
which is also why the U.S. backs that particular faction of Kurds.
I want to sideline into something a little bit different here before we close, because I think it needs to be touched on. That does tie in with all of this. Iran has historically, for the first time since the Iranian Revolution, given permission for a foreign country to host military and active military operations out of Iranian territory. And this is Russia, out of the Hamadan Air Base. Russia has been trying to conduct bomber flights. They can't use their Hamamim air base in Syria because the bombers, particularly the 222s, the Tupolevs, are too heavy for this air base. And they can't fly over Turkish territory because, despite the reproachment, Erdogan still doesn't let Russia fly over Turkish territory to bomb what are his proxies in Syria. So, right. And the flights going from Russia, through Iran, through Iraq, and into Syria were extremely long. They had to be refueled en route, right? They had to carry a much smaller payloads because they had to carry more fuel. And crucially, as has been announced by the Ministry of Defense, proxies that they were bombing, in particular I'm talking the Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-linked proxies around Aleppo, have increasingly been able to avoid these bomber attacks to a degree that speaks to far more coincidence.
Yeah, when you leave Russia bound for Syria, U.S. Surveillance can notify these people, okay, they're coming, and they've got plenty of time to move.
Exactly. And the Russian Ministry of Defense has said that someone, without naming who, has probably been supplying them with satellite info, which is the only way they could detect this. So operating Russian bombers out of Iran does a number of things. One, it vastly shortens the wear and tear on the planes. They're flying a much shorter distance. We're talking some 700 kilometers instead of 2,000. You know, right. That's a threefold cut. Right. Instead of carrying more fuel and having to refuel, they're able to carry much greater payloads to deliver, which increases the intensity of the attacks they're capable of on both ISIS in eastern Syria and Al-Qaeda and friends in Aleppo. And third of all, this cuts down on any reaction time if anyone is warned by the U.S. or anyone else significantly. Cuts the reaction time down by two-thirds. So it will make the accuracy as well as the efficiency of these attacks. So this is a big move. Geopolitically speaking, this move is huge because it indicates closer military and geopolitical ties between Russia and Iran, which is a big threat for Saudi, U.S., and Israeli hegemony over the Middle East and beyond. And it has to be recognized that what the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and friends have done in Libya, in Syria, are doing in Yemen is what has pushed Russia and Iran closer together. With all of this, so you know they've created this nightmare for themselves, and I expect to see Russian and Iranian and Chinese. They're getting a little bit more involved in the Syria with some training announced of Syrian government forces. This pushes them further and further together. It is an inevitable and entirely foreseeable backlash to U.S. regime change and hegemonic policies in the region.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I started reading an article Andrew Karibko wrote over the past few days talking about Russia and China. The presentation.
This is one of his good pieces.
Yeah, and particularly the conceptual framework that he used is interesting. Where talking about with Russia and China working in tandem in terms of foreign policy, that there are places where China has interests, but because of national antagonisms, can't go. That Russia can go and mediate, and vice versa. For example, China can go to Poland and other places in Eastern Europe. Where there's this antipathy towards Russia and make deals that, you know, benefit both, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, Western officials, Western theorists, foreign policy circles have been trying, I think, a lot of wishful thinking to downplay Sino-Russian condominium. But, of course, it's their biggest fear. And adding Iran and, you know, potentially somewhere down the road, India into the mix, is a nightmare for them.
Right.
And China, the majority of China's relations are focused on the Asia Pacific, on their naval trade and their big trade relations, their frenemy trade relations, you know, where both depend on in each other with the U.S. Russia's biggest relations by nature are with the EU, who is their, as a bloc, at least, their biggest trade partner. China is still their biggest single trade partner. But as a bloc, they do much more business with Europe. They supply them with energy. And by being able to set their backs comfortably to each other with a completely demilitarized border, they are both able to concentrate respectively on, for Russia, the EU, and for China, the U.S. Not entirely conflictual, but not entirely cooperative relations, obviously, with these two respective countries either. But what you're talking about here, this more combined balancing, this more integrated foreign policies, that Karibko, I think, in this article at least, very correctly describes, is a further step down the road of relations and shows a complexity and a level of agreement that has been recognized, more commonly.
And Iran is an interesting place to see the relations between the two, with particularly this expression of common interest with Russia from Iran, letting them use the military base. China has been doing some development projects there as well. And, of course, Iran is a significant part of the movement by China, ultimately towards Africa.
Yeah, I mean, and no one should underestimate the importance of it's not commonly said of Iran to China for energy, because Iran is a very important and growing segment of China's energy mixture, as is Russia. And China needs energy. China needs huge amounts of energy. And both Russia and Iran are, at the moment, their most secure sources. So they are doubling down on those. They need Africa for other natural resources. But Russia and Iran represent more stable sources of energy for them.
And that's a major geostrategic change. If you go back to 1953, for example, the coup against Mossadegh was engineered to secure U.S. access to Iran's oil, and now it's available to China.
Yeah, well, this has never been about ownership, right? Exclusive ownership. All right. A lot of people get this idea wrong, that if the U.S. goes into Iraq, it means they want all of Iraq's energy for themselves. No.
Right,
it's not.
Right.
It's about control of energy flows.
And markets. Right.
Yeah. You control. You privatize. You control the U.S.-based or British-based corporations that are in charge of that oil, in charge of the distribution of that oil. That is the type of power that is actually probably at the end more efficient than direct national exclusive control of that resource.
Right. I mean, you have a confluence there of the interests of the actual, owners, as they end up, the people who are going to make the money on it, and of the elite in general in the West, because that control exists and it can be used as a geostrategic tool.
Yeah, leverage. Yeah, leverage tool and all of these things.
So going forward, what do you see developing on the ground around all of this stuff?
Okay, I expect to see this problem with the Kurds evaporate, not entirely go away, but I expect to see Russia smack some heads together and hopefully convince the two sides to, recognize their greater existential common enemies at this point. The real flashpoint is still around Aleppo. Contrary to Western media reports, this huge Islamic Army of conquest offensive with the group formerly known as al-Nusra, the formerly known as al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call them now, Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, I believe they're calling themselves these days, Ahrar al-Sham and all the others with FSA groups included, they had an offensive to break recently announced siege of eastern Aleppo, which they've held for several years by the Syrian Arab Army. They claimed with this huge effective of several thousand that came across through Idlib from across the Turkish border that they had broken the siege. This is triumphalism. They did succeed in knocking back Syrian forces from an artillery academy, an apartment block, several strategic hills, but this did not provide any serious corridor that they can get any serious amount of supplies into eastern Aleppo. And the Syrian Arab Army has had a counterattack, and we see some fight back and some status quo lines developing, but largely the Syrian Arab Army siege of Aleppo is intact. The Russians continue to provide close air support, not only in southern Aleppo, but on also any potential recruits, reinforcements, and supplies coming in from Idlib via Turkey. So, in the most recent days, we have seen a huge propaganda operation being made out of a Syrian child who is, according to Al-Qaeda on the ground and, you know, the NGOs that cooperate with Al-Qaeda, like the White Helmets, of a Syrian Sunni boy in East Aleppo, one Omran, who was very brilliantly photographed as having survived a supposed Russian airstrike on East Aleppo, which the Russian government denies. You know, this is a civil war, come jihad, come proxy war, and most of it is urban based. There are civilian casualties on all sides. As every time every the day. U.S. makes an airstrike in Manbij or Fallujah or anywhere else when they're liberating cities, and the rebels continue to shell West Aleppo, causing in recent weeks the exact same amount of deaths, exactly equivalent that Syrian government and Russian airstrikes have caused in and around East Aleppo.
And not for nothing.
Just two weeks ago,
they could take those pictures. Let me just say,
Obama-funded group brutally saw off the head of a Syrian child. There's no poster child being made of this. That is that, however, it's tragic whenever children die in war. But this city, Eastern Aleppo, is held by Al-Qaeda and friends. Let's not lose sight of that. These are head-chopping, suicide-bombing jihadis, whatever else we want to, you know, make out of them as our proxies, as Western proxies in Syria. And this is entirely cynical. It is being used by the Western media as a battering ram at this point against the Obama administration, calling for overt intervention, overt military regime change, which will not happen, at least until Hillary Clinton takes office. But it's entirely cynical. It's not being used as a call to end the violence, but as being used as a call for more war and violence.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, of course, as we close, how many photographs like that you could take in any city in Iraq since 2003, or really since 1991.
You can follow my and others' Twitter feeds and see a number of any number of adorable and tragic Syrian children that, you know, were survived or were killed by jihadi shelling and other atrocities committed by them. Real quick, if I could, I want to do some friend shout outs of sources that people should follow. If you don't speak Arabic, like I don't, and want to follow the events in Syria, Twitter, at The Arab Source. It's Al Mazdar News, run by a Lebanese. I find him to be, of course, pro-government, as I am, but largely above the board, and he's not afraid to point out when they've done things badly and are losing, which is really important. The Moon of Alabama blog is great for across-the-board geopolitical interests and getting beyond, and inside the mainstream news stories. Moon of Alabama, again, it's on Twitter, and it's got its own blog page. And three articles, if I could, that I really want to highlight for you. Out of the War on the Rocks blog and Twitter page again, there is a piece, Washington's Sunni Myth and the Civil Wars in Syria and Iraq. It's a long form. It's very important. The jihadi apologists and the Western foreign policy elite hate this article, so you read it.
Yeah, for sure.
The Guardian has an excellent piece by the philosopher John Gray. It's called The Truth About Evil, and it goes into the West's infantile demonization of figures of evil in Syria and elsewhere. It is another brilliant, long-form weekend read. And the last piece I want to shout out is on Joshua Landis's blog. Joshua Landis is a professor of Middle East and Syria at Oklahoma University. He's considered probably the foremost authority on Syria in the U.S. There is a post on his blog, an article, Who is to Blame for Syria's Nightmare? I think it's an excellent reading, and it concludes, I'll just read this single statement out, without a single exception, every armed group in Syria today is committed to ruling by Sharia law. This is why Assad and his supporters will refuse to give up and continue fighting.
And, of course, they can reach you at Facebook, Mark Sloboda, S-L-E-B-O-D-A, and Twitter. What's your Twitter address?
At Mark Sloboda 1.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Tom, thanks for having me. Always great to be on CPR.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.